Thank you very much, Dean Wall. I'm very honored to be with you this evening and to share some of my thoughts and observations concerning the health consequences of war. Jimmy Carter, former President of the United States, said in his acceptance speech for the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo last December, quote, "War may sometimes be a necessary evil, but no matter how necessary, it is always an evil, never a good. We will not learn to live together in peace by killing each other's children." One way of looking at the health consequences of war is to look at the statistics that we in public health are often expert in gathering to give some idea of the magnitude of the impact of war. For example, with regard to Gulf War I, fought in 1991, it's estimated that approximately 50,000 civilians died, about 10,000 during the war itself, and another 40,000 or so in the several months immediately after the war. Since that time, in the 12 years since 1991, UNICEF estimates that approximately 5,000 children deaths, excessive children deaths, deaths that otherwise would not have occurred in Iraq per month as a result of sanctions and ongoing destruction of the infrastructure, that is, the water treatment plants, the electrical grids, the healthcare system, the lingering damage as a result of Gulf War I. Almost a half of Iraqi children have been malnourished during this period. Perhaps as many as two-thirds have suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. 10,000 homes were destroyed during Gulf War I in Iraq, and there were almost 2 million refugees and internally displaced persons as a result of that war. Infant mortality and under five childhood mortality went up considerably. Life expectancy dropped from 66 years to 61 years. The ranking of Iraq on the United Nations Development Program's Quality of Life Index fell from 50 in 1991 to 125 at the present time. And the Iraqi economy, in terms of its gross national product, fell from $66 billion a year to, at one point, less than a quarter of $1 billion a year. Another way of examining the health impact of war is considering the images that we have in our minds over the years about the impact of war on people. For example, in Cambodia, many children and adults are amputees as a result of having stepped on landmines. One out of every 250 people in Cambodia is an amputee as a result of having stepped on a landmine, and they are the lucky ones in a certain sense. They survived the landmine explosion. In Vietnam, between 2 and 3 million civilians died during what we refer to as the Vietnam War. In a sense, it was the second or maybe even the third Vietnam War in the 20th century, with many civilians injured or killed as a result of bombing and shooting. And we have in our minds more recently the images of Iraqi citizens, civilians, many of them women and children, who have suffered from bombs or bullets that have gone astray or being in the wrong place at the wrong time, often going to healthcare institutions, mainly hospitals, that were ill-equipped to handle the vast numbers of people who were seriously injured. It's further complicated by the looting that occurred in the final stages of the war. Some of the images we have as far as the human face of war also have to do with refugees. There are 35 million refugees and internally displaced persons in the world. In Rwanda, for example, or leaving Rwanda in July of 1994, a million Rwandan refugees left for Zaire within a two-week period of time to avert the genocide that was taking place in their own country. Often refugees live for a period of time in makeshift refugee camps in places like Mozambique or in Cambodia, where refugees were refugees sometimes in refugee camps for 10 years or more before many of them were forcibly repatriated back to Cambodia. And indeed, there are refugees in the Middle East who have been in refugee status for decades as a result of war and other civil unrest. Some refugees suffer serious injuries. A child I saw in a Cambodian refugee camp, an 8-year-old child, suffered paralysis of his left arm after being shot in his left shoulder. His 4-year-old brother was killed when he was carrying him through a so-called no man's zone between the borders of Cambodia and Thailand. Many children I saw in that refugee camp who were escaping not only the civil war that was going on in Cambodia, but also the genocidal regime of Pol Pot, so-called killing fields from 1975 to 1979, when somewhere between 1 to 2 million of Cambodia's people died of malnutrition, lack of medical care, and being executed, many of them because they were nothing more than educated or wore glasses. Children in a refugee camp, I remember, were many of them were malnourished. I remember a 7-year-old girl who weighed only 27 pounds, the same weight as my 1-year-old son, who I almost didn't recognize when I came home because he was normally nourished. In that refugee camp and other refugee camps, and among internally displaced persons in places like Iraq, children suffer from polio and other infectious diseases. And some children, one I remember from the refugee camp in Thailand among the Cambodian refugees, a 12-year-old boy who had so-called hysterical or psychological blindness as a result of having watched both of his parents being executed. Wars have tremendously negative adverse impacts on children. Many refugees and internally displaced persons became refugees or internally displaced as a result of Gulf War I, and more recently, many internally displaced people were internally displaced as a result of the fighting in Iraq, becoming refugees on very short notice. Malnutrition has been a serious problem in many, as a result of many wars and sanctions related to wars. In Iraq, almost half of the children, as I mentioned a moment ago, one study showed that roughly 43% of 1 to 3-year-olds in Baghdad were either mildly, moderately, or severely malnourished after the first Gulf War, during a period of sanctions in which foods and medicines were very limited in terms of what foods and medicines could get into Iraq. Many children become soldiers against their will. In Sierra Leone recently, hundreds of children were released after intensive negotiations. All too often, though, the children who become soldiers are killed or seriously injured and are not freed from that status. Other children are forced to become sexual slaves to the military. One of the important facts with regard to the impact of war on civilians, and perhaps the most important fact to take away from this presentation, is that increasingly the percentage of all deaths during war are civilian deaths. During World War I, 14% of all deaths were among civilians. During World War II, 67%. And in wars in the 1990s, approximately 90% of all deaths were deaths to civilians. So this is a particular concern, not only civilians who are caught in the crossfire, but civilians who are increasingly targeted as a strategy of war, including, for example, the women who have been raped as a strategy of war, including in the former Yugoslavia. And many of us have images from the internet and from watching television and reading the newspaper over the last several weeks in Gulf War II of not only Iraqi military, many of whom were serving with a gun pointed to their head, an Iraqi gun from Saddam Hussein's henchmen, or many of the deaths, of course, occurred among civilians, and the people of Iraq mourn. We may never know the total number of civilian and military deaths to Iraqis during the Second Gulf War. By the way, I use the term Second Gulf War, but arguably the war that just took place is Gulf War III, because Iraq and Iran suffered through Gulf War I from 1980 to 1988, during which time 1 million Iraqis and 1 million Iranians were believed to have been killed and many more seriously injured. A woman recently looked at the makeshift grave of her husband. Her husband and 9 other Iraqi civilians were killed by mistake when American military opened fire on them as their car went through a checkpoint and did not heed the warnings in English to stop. Civilians have been targeted in wars, of course, many times before. In World War II, carpet bombing took place in Osaka, Japan, for example. There was intensive carpet bombing with huge craters in the middle of the city and many people and their homes destroyed. And carpet bombing was a strategy employed by both sides during World War II. Bombs during Gulf War, what I'm calling Gulf War I in 1991, damaged Iraqi neighborhoods in Baghdad and elsewhere in Basra when so-called smart bombs sometimes went astray. And during the war in Serbia, people mourned the loss of their neighborhoods when similarly smart bombs went astray and destroyed civilian housing and the people living in them. Many Iraqis today mourn the loss of homes and neighborhoods, and in addition to loved ones who died during the war in the last several weeks. In an uprising in Karbala after the first Gulf War, what I'm calling the first Gulf War, in the town of Karbala, about 60 miles south of Baghdad, a hospital wing was partially destroyed during the uprising that followed Gulf War I. And more recently, medical and dental offices and hospitals were destroyed, not only by bombs, but the looting that went on after while the war was winding down in the last week or so. We need to remember the images that we have of American Army troops and Marines quickly surrounding the Ministry of Oil, but not guarding the hospitals or the clinics, or for that matter, the museums and the libraries and the other centers of civilization in Baghdad and elsewhere. After the fighting was winding down in the last week or so, even children became involved in the looting of doctors' offices and clinics. Sometimes patients were taken out of their beds and put on the floor while looters carried the empty bed out of the hospital. Women and men often carried their children to hospitals where no medical care was available, in part because of the looting, in part because hospitals had run out of supplies and medicines, and in part because doctors and nurses were not able to get to the hospitals because of the fighting that was going on. Now, there's much damage to the environment as a result of war. In Gulf War I, for example, there was damage to the water supply systems and the water treatment plants, such that women had to, who were gathering water for their families, went to branches of the Tigris River and elsewhere, bodies of water that they knew to be polluted. But given the fact that there was no other available source of water, they got water from those sources, knowing full well that it might be dangerous to drink, but potentially dangerous water was a better alternative than dying of thirst. Similar scenes were repeated in the war that just took place when the water treatment plants were partially destroyed in Basra and elsewhere. Other kinds of damage to the environment occurred during wartime. In the Vietnam War, the American military destroyed mangrove forests and defoliated trees using Agent Orange and other toxic chemicals. They also destroyed mangrove swamps by bombing. And one of the long-term effects of the bombing of those mangrove swamps is craters that remain in much of Vietnam to the present day that have accumulated stagnant water and are a source for our place where mosquitoes breed, mosquitoes that carry malaria and other serious diseases. There were over 600 oil well fires set by retreating Iraqi troops in Kuwait during Gulf War I that caused a great deal of ecological damage to the environment, damage to birds and fish and other wildlife, and also caused acute respiratory disease and potentially chronic respiratory symptoms as well. And although there haven't been as many, nowhere near as many oil field fires in Gulf War II, nevertheless, the fighting has brought about a great deal of smoke and fires and explosions, which no doubt have had at least some effect on the acute symptoms of Iraqis Iraqis who were breathing in the polluted air. Some of the impacts of war on the environment include the preparation for war. in Metlano, a small town in Russia, 4 miles from the Chelyabinsk nuclear weapons plant. The whole area is now unpopulated because it is radioactive. A Geiger counter held above a nearby stream has shown that the background levels of radiation are 28 times what they should be as a result of this kind of contamination. In the early 50s, there were open air tests in Nevada, in the United States, where American servicemen and women, as well as people who lived not that far downwind from where these tests were taking place, these people have now, years later, suffered cancer and some other diseases as a result of exposure to radiation that was then thought to be safe. In places in the United States, and in fact in many countries, toxic or radioactive wastes sit in areas where eventually they may contaminate groundwater or surface water unless better protections are built to prevent that from happening. A few words about so-called weapons of mass destruction, chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. Weapons inspectors in the early 1990s identified and ultimately destroyed chemical weapons in Iraq. Some weapons, some missiles, for example, and rockets containing sarin and other banned chemical weapons. In 1994 and 1995, in two separate episodes in Japan, a terrorist group killed a number of people, 19 in all, by releasing sarin gas, highly poisonous toxic gas, that could have indeed resulted in hundreds, if not thousands, of deaths had not people been promptly evacuated. Among the chemical weapons are mustard gas that was banned after World War I when it was used extensively. Is not only lethal, but people who are less extensively exposed suffer severe respiratory problems and severe skin lesions. With regard to biologic weapons, in the war on terrorism, our government, specifically the CDC, has identified six agents that are, they feel, highly likely to be used at some point as biologic weapons. They include anthrax, smallpox, plague, tularemia, botulism, or at least botulinum toxin, and viral hemorrhagic fevers. So these are an area of concern. In the 1950s and early 1960s, the United States engaged at Fort Detrick, Maryland, in developing offensive biologic weapons. The Nixon administration proposed in 1969 a biologic weapons convention, feeling that it was in our enlightened self-interest to rid the world of biologic weapons. And this convention went into full force in 1975. Over 140 nations, including the United States, have signed this international treaty that bans the production or use of biologic weapons. The United States government claims that it is only engaged in defensive biologic weapons research since that time. However, there's evidence that we've probably come pretty close to, if not gone over, the line that divides defensive weapons research from offensive weapons research. With regard to nuclear weapons, in 1946, we exploded a hydrogen bomb on Bikini Atoll in the Pacific, totally destroying that island. In fact, for about 50 years afterwards, the fishing grounds around where the island had been were fishing was prohibited in these waters because of the radioactivity. In 1945, as you all know, the United States dropped nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, accounting for about 200,000 deaths. The atomic bombs that we dropped at that time were 1/1,000th the explosive power of the nuclear weapons that are present today in the world, held by 9 nations, and there's evidence that an increasing number of nations, including North Korea, are working towards developing nuclear weapons. We must also remember that what we call conventional weapons can also be weapons of mass destruction when they're used in large number and used indiscriminately. And although 68% of the weapons dropped from airplanes and including cruise missiles sent from aircraft carriers in the Gulf during Gulf War II, although 68% were precision-guided weapons, 32% of them were not. and these weapons often fell on civilian neighborhoods in places like Baghdad. Another related problem is the unexploded munitions. Many of the cluster bombs and bomblets that were dropped on Baghdad in the past several weeks did not explode. These remain in large numbers around many neighborhoods. Children may think that they're toys or potentially fun to play with, only to witness them exploding in their hands. So this is another problem, the unexploded ordnance. There are two other broad problems that I'd like to mention with regard to war and public health. One is the fact that increasingly, by using violence, by using war as a way of solving disputes that could be solved by other means, we're demonstrating to the world and we're demonstrating to our children that violence is the way of resolving disputes. It's no surprise then that this attitude in part contributes to the fact that firearm-related fatalities, the rate of firearm-related fatalities in the United States is far in excess, 6-7 times greater than that in the nearest nation when any kind of analysis is done. A second issue is the diversion of resources, not only during wars, but in the so-called preparation for war, for defense or military expenditures. In many African nations, for example, many-fold amounts of money are spent per capita on military expenditures as opposed to health expenditures. In Ethiopia in 1990, for example, $16 were spent per capita by the government for military expenditures compared to only $1 per capita for health-related expenditures. Another way of looking at this issue is the question of trade-offs. For example, in a recent year, Nigeria bought 80 battle tanks from the United Kingdom. It could have theoretically used that money to immunize 2 million children and to provide family planning for 17 million couples. Now, I used to say this kind of analysis was a theoretical analysis that people did in think tanks or argued about in academic centers. But in fact, recently in Brazil, the newly elected president, President Lula, has decided not to purchase advanced weapons, advanced airplanes and their weapon systems, and instead use the money for improving the education system, the public education system for the children of Brazil. It's no surprise then that in 1993, the United States ranked first in arms exports, first in military expenditures, first in military technology. We still rank first in all those 10 years later. At that time, we ranked 10th in life expectancy and 21st in infant mortality rate. We now rank 24th in life expectancy and 28th in infant mortality rate as the percentage of military expenditures has gone up in recent years. Another related analysis is the disproportionate ownership of wealth in the world. And whether you do this analysis by countries or by people, and sometimes even within nations, the upper 20% of the population own or control 85% of the wealth. The lower 20% of the population, or the poorest 20% of countries, control 1% of the wealth. The United States military, as I said, protected the Ministry of Oil in recent weeks with soldiers surrounding the Ministry of Oil, but at the same time, we did not protect hospitals or museums or other parts of Iraqi civilization that are really central not only to survival of the people, but to survival of their culture. When the war in Iraq began, roughly a month ago, two of the aims put forward by President Bush as reasons to fight the war were alleged connections between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, and also the presence of weapons of mass destruction. Despite 5 weeks or so since the start of that war, I think 5 weeks ago tonight, no weapons of mass destruction have been found, and no credible links with al-Qaeda have been demonstrated. There are other important questions that remain to be answered. In this morning, after the war, does democracy in Iraq stand a chance? As was asked as a question on a recent front page of the New York Times magazine. It remains to be seen if democracy stands a chance and whether our definition of democracy is concordant with what the Iraqis may choose as their form of government or the people or parties that they want to represent them. These are important questions, as is the ultimate fate of the Iraqi people. Will indeed they be better off as a result of this liberation or not? We will know in the weeks and months and years to follow. There is likely to be a huge humanitarian crisis in the weeks ahead as people run out of the food that they stored prior to the war, as water becomes in increasing demand, as the needs of the healthcare system become more and more apparent. There's another important question that I think we all need to ask ourselves, and that is, have we become, that is, we as a nation, have we become what we hate? William Irvin Thompson, a professor then at York University in England, asked that question about 30 years ago in an op-ed piece in the New York Times during the height of the Vietnam War. This is a question we might ask of ourselves as a nation today, as we fight preemptive wars and perhaps get ready for more, as we as a nation, or at least our government, undermines the United Nations and flaunts international treaties that we have been a signatory to, and as our government abrogates civil rights and ignores the needs of our neediest while proposing more tax cuts for the rich. Have we become what we hate? And I return to the words of Jimmy Carter in closing, quote, "War may sometimes be a necessary evil, but no matter how necessary, it is always an evil, never a good." Thank you very much.